You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of July 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
There's a lot we want to know. We certainly want to know about several of the meetings that have been alleged to have taken place. Obviously, the meeting with Donald Jr. and the several Russians that we now know were in that meeting. But also his meeting that was alleged to have taken place with the head of the VEB Bank, a sanctioned Russian bank.
President Donald Trump's senior advisor and, not coincidentally, son-in-law testifies to Congress. My guests Mari Bion and Sebastian Borger will be discussing that and the day's other top stories, including a surprisingly stiff-spined response by Poland's president to parliamentary attempts to gut the country's judiciary. German opposition leader Martin Schulz's effort to make immigration an election issue, and the possible next front in Donald Trump's ongoing battle with CNN. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Sebastian Borger, the London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung, and Mari Bion, a UK correspondent for French media. Welcome both, and we will begin today in Poland, where President Andrzej Duda has surprised many, not least Poland's government, by announcing that he will veto plans plucked from the what-could-possibly-go-wrong file to replace the country's independent judiciary with government nominees slash stooges. This plan took the form of three reforms passed by Parliament, prompting widespread protest and threats of EU sanctions. President Duda has declared that he will kill two of the reforms, leaving the one which allows the Justice Minister to name the heads of lower courts. Mari, first of all, President Duda is a former member of the ruling Law and Justice Party. Was the ruling Justice Party kind of expecting him to roll over on this one?
Well, that's what he's been doing since he's been president.
They were betting with form.
That's what they were trying to have basically an ally at the presidency. But apparently he decided that this one was a bit too much. He's a jurist himself. He used to practice law, if I understand correctly. So he consulted various people and saw that maybe it was going a bit too far, and that he has the right and the powers to oppose a decision by his prime minister. So that's why he decided to do it. Decided to take a stand, apparently.
Sebastian, do we get the impression that he was moved by the protests, which took place across Poland and were quite large and quite determined looking?
Well, there are two reasons I would have thought that he could have been moved by. One are those protests, which have been going on for weeks on end, tens of thousands of people, which really brought Poland to the verge of, you know, a very serious standoff. And the other one, of course, could be that the European Union, after months of patient dialogue, came down pretty hard on Poland recently and said, if you don't desist from this, we will impose sanctions.
This was the threat of Article 7.
The threat of Article
7. Now the second most famous article.
And quite rightly so, you know. And I find it very interesting, that aspect of the story, because, of course, the EU, in my view, has been far too lenient to Hungary, where a similar right-wing government has introduced very similar reforms. And now there's a much bigger boy on the, or girl, whatever, a much bigger partner, EU partner, in Brussels' crosshair, and they're acting tougher. I find that very interesting.
Just to follow that point up, Sebastian, you make the point that Hungary as well has meandered somewhat down the path of populist authoritarianism. Is it weird that this is happening in two countries which have a relatively recent memory of, you know, actual full-blown authoritarianism?
Well, it's, I suppose that's part of the reason, isn't it? Because there is a large part in both countries, I think particularly the rural population, which feels sidelined by the reforms that came in, by the tremendous upsurge in GDP and standard of living, but also which feels betrayed because parts of the old communist elite got back into power. I mean, the worst worst example, of course, is famous Hungarian prime minister whose name I can never pronounce, Jujari or something like that, who was recorded openly saying it's important to lie to people. That poisoned the atmosphere in Hungary. In Poland, it's of course harder to explain, but the country is split down the middle. You have to look at the election results and you'll see a little bit like Brexit country or indeed the US of America, the metropolitan centers voting for the left, or at least for the slightly rational right of center parties, and the rural, particularly the east towards Ukraine and Belarus, voting heavily for this very right-wing, very unpleasant party of the Prime Minister.
Mari, there is a temptation, and hopefully not a misapplied one, to regard this as something of a victory for, you know, the rule of law, democratic norms, common sense, etc. Is there, however, a bleaker analysis which suggests that this is what the Law and Justice Party wanted all along, that they did that common bargaining thing of asking for something ridiculous, knowing that it'd get knocked back, and then settling for what they actually originally wanted anyway? This is, as we noted in the introduction, one of their three reforms is going to be waved through.
Yes, and the third one is, if I understand correctly, more at the local level.
Indeed.
And the other two was quite obviously against the way the judiciary was working, and very much putting into question the relationship and the separation between the two powers, the politics and the executive, and the judiciary. This one might perhaps go a bit more under the radar. So I don't know Polish politics enough and the ruling party enough to say that, yes, that was all along what they wanted to do. They asked for something so extravagant they knew it would be rejected, just to have the third one. I think they wanted the three of them, if I understand correctly. They wanted the three of them because they want to reshape the country at the image that they want to, that they have for their own country. So the three reform would have worked very well together in their design of the country. This one, what's going to be interesting is see how this third reform that's been passed, how it's going to be implemented without the two other legs that were the two other reforms that they wanted to implement at the same time.
I mean, there is the option that the parliamentary party does have of trying to override the veto, that they do need a 3/5 majority in the parliament to do that, which seems unlikely. But is it possible that, following up from that point, we could see them putting a watered down version of the reforms to Duda, which is pretty much what they wanted anyway, which doesn't excite the same amount of public protest or sanction from the European Commission, and they just about get away with it?
That's definitely possible, but I wouldn't underestimate this veto. I mean, as you pointed out, he used to be a member of the party. He's now an independent. He wouldn't have done this lightly, and again, whatever, whether it's the protests or the EU or a combination of the two, I think he will, behind closed doors, have words with the Prime Minister and, of course, the true leader of the party, Kaczynski, and say, look, guys, I mean, you better come up with a solution which is acceptable to our friends in Brussels and elsewhere.
Okay, well, let's look now at Germany, where, if polls are to be believed, Angela Merkel appears comfortably on course to be returned for a fourth term as Chancellor. Not for the first time in political history, however, an opponent lagging away behind has sought to make an issue of immigration. Merkel's principal rival, Martin Schulz of the Social Democrats, has volubly reminded Germans of the summer of 2015, when nearly 900,000 refugees and migrants were taken into the country. Schulz has noted, correctly, in fairness, that these people have not stopped coming. Arrivals in Italy are up 17% year on year. Sebastian, first of all, because this is your home country's election, is this going to work for Schulz? Is immigration still potentially a live issue in Germany?
Immigration certainly is a live issue. I can't see that it would work for him, because people will turn round, I would have thought, and rightly ask, well, what are you planning to do about it? I mean, he's now giving interviews, saying he has travelled to Brussels already to talk to his old crony, Jean-Claude Juncker. He, of course, having been the president of the European Parliament, talking to the Commission about paying money to countries, to EU countries that take migrants. So far, we've had a great debate in the EU about countries unwilling, countries obviously amongst them Poland and Hungary, unwilling to take migrants. Now, are we seriously suggesting we want to pay them to do their humanitarian duty? I can't see that. But worse, I think, is that the Social Democrats are totally opposed to any measures which could actually turn the flow. In other words, any measures that might where you employ the German Navy in the Mediterranean to support the Italian Navy to shut down the routes where people earn serious money, and commit serious crimes, murder and kidnap and extortion, by sending these very poor people from mainly Bangladesh, Nigeria, and Sudan across the sea in vehicles which aren't seaworthy. You know, you've got to get tough with the causes. You can't just say, it's a great problem. You've got to have solutions.
Yeah, Mari, when seen from France, how different, I guess, does Germany's discussion of these issues seem? Because obviously in the last French presidential election, we had an extremely far-right candidate going all the way through to the runoff, whereas in Germany, the faintly comparable party Alternative for Deutschland has collapsed to somewhere in single figures.
Well, yes. Well, indeed. Well, in France, I mean, the elections has passed, which gives more leeway to the government to try and do something. But it's true that the crisis that we had in Calais and that we're having now in the southeast on the border of Italy is still very much ripe. And it's becoming, as it's been becoming for some time, but more of a local issue than a national one. Because, of course, now that they are elected, the politicians know that it's a bit of a muddy territory. So they don't want to talk about it more than they have to, except, of course, in the southeast and around the region of Calais, where the question of illegal immigrants is still very much important and very much into the day-to-day life of the people. So at the moment, the question is very much about how can, just like Germany is doing, how can Europe prepare a concerted response to this crisis, and how can Europe step up their game to try and resolve the crisis? France wants to be at the forehead of this solution, but at the same time, they don't want to put it again at the heart of the agenda. So they want to be the knight in shiny armor at the end, but at the moment, they want to be seen working hard behind closed door more than making it another issue.
And what do you think, Sebastian? Why isn't, you know, sort of obvious, upfront, barefaced immigrant bashing of the sort we saw in France and have indeed seen here in the United Kingdom able to gain as much traction in Germany? Is it just a question of recent history where only a small percentage of the population doesn't get a little bit squeamish at the spectacle of a political party otherizing foreigners?
It's definitely to do with our history, no doubt about it. It's also, you know, that people do understand that we have we have migration flows through the world, and we have to do our humanitarian duty by those who actually suffer from persecution or have to flee civil wars. So the discussion 2 years ago was very much about refugees from Syria, of course, and everybody could see what a complete mess Syria was and indeed is. And so I think people were, which you always have to remember, which the pictures of people fleeing from Nazi Germany, and then after the Second World War, Germans fleeing from Poland and all sorts of countries further east in Europe towards Germany, are still very much ingrained in the German psyche. And I think there is a willingness to help. If it's clear that these are persecuted people, and also that they are either willing to integrate or indeed after some time, as happened in Kosovo, to go back. But what happens now, of course, is people coming from countries which have absolutely no... I mean, Sudan is an exception. Bangladesh and Nigeria, I haven't heard of any civil wars recently. We are aiding and abetting criminals by not tackling the problem in the Mediterranean. And as long as the EU and countries like Germany and France do something about that, I think we're guilty of as I said, aiding and abetting.
Mari, just a final thought on this. How is the German election being seen from France? Is it followed closely in a way that, for example, it really isn't here in the United Kingdom?
I think there's this idea that Angela Merkel is there to stay. That's the way it's being seen at the moment, because of course Emmanuel Macron wants to further his relationship with Germany, and he wants to very much put again in center stage the Franco-German couple, as we call them. And so that's very much the prism through which it's being seen. Of course, there's of course this idea that that's the far right, but the far right is less powerful than it is in Germany. So that's also an interest in France. How come the far right, which was more vocal and in the street that used to be in France, how come it was so high just a few months ago, and now it's just is not really a threat anymore? So that's something that's quite interesting as well, seen from France. And of course Martin Schulz is someone who's not very well known in France, although it was someone very important in Europe. He's not very well known. So you see Angela Merkel, but you don't see any specific candidate in front of her. So it's very much the Angela election as being seen from France. Of course, within the media, there's more in depth and all that, but I'm talking about how the way French people are seeing it. It's very much the Angela election. See if she's going to go on or not, but I don't think many people will be able to say who could take over if Angela Merkel isn't re-elected.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Sebastian Borger and Mari Bjorn. Coming up next, it's Jared Kushner's turn to attempt to explain himself.
Summer is officially here, and so is Monocle's bumper July-August double issue. Here we celebrate quality of life and reveal this year's rundown of the top 25 cities to live in worldwide. We also meet the people striving to make life in their cities better, from the mayor of Los Angeles to the sunny team that looks after Tokyo's parks and gardens, to the urban heroes giving back to their hometowns. Meanwhile, in design, we cast our gaze up to the rooftops in Milan and find a hidden and surprisingly verdant world above the fray. And of course, we've always got room for a bit of pure hedonism as we dance the night away in Tel Aviv, unwind in Finland's most inviting and steamiest company retreats, and tuck into some sun-kissed beach food in Valencia. And speaking of sun-kissed, we also sit down with Mario Testino for his hypothetical last meal. That's all in the July-August issue of Monocle, on newsstands everywhere now. Or head to monocle.com to become a subscriber.
You are back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Sebastian Borger and Mari Bjorn. And let's look now at Washington, D.C., where senior advisor to the president, Jared Kushner, whose qualifications for that role include being married to the president's daughter, has been testifying to a closed-door session of the Senate Intelligence Committee investigating allegations of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. Mr. Kushner's opening statement, released ahead of testifying, maintained the traditional family line of insisting that nothing proper occurred, and if it did, they didn't realize And anyway, it was really no big deal. Murray, first of all, having seen the opening statement, are we buying Jared Kushner's whole well-meaning, naive bit, all this stuff about, well, I've never worked on a campaign before, so I didn't really know how any of this work, what do I know, etc., etc.?
Well, I guess some people do buy into it because they want to see Trump the way he presented himself and his family as victim of a witch hunt. And the fact that Jared Kushner has always been the shadow counselor, the one who's always there but has never utter a word, and the one who seemed very cautious at the face of it. How can he be accused of anything when he's never done anything very concrete in a way that the people have seen that's been very publicized? So that's this way of seeing things. But of course, yes, it was his first campaign. But I mean, the way he's defending himself and the 11-page statement show that he knew what was happening and he knew how a campaign was supposed to be run. Otherwise, he would not have said, "I didn't do that in particular." For example, for the back channel, he's accused of perhaps having tried to install a back channel between Washington when Trump and Russia to discuss about Syria.
Well, that was a weird moment because he said he had a meeting with the ambassador after the election and he asked if they had, quote, an existing communications channel. Mm-hmm. He was told there wasn't. And then he says, "I did not suggest a secret back channel." But they're both kind of the same thing, aren't they? If you're asking if one already exists, that's sort of suggesting there either should be one or is one, or you wish there was one, doesn't it?
Well, I guess so. And that's why it's quite clever, because either way, it's not very clear. So he can say, well, that's not my doing. I was just trying to make sure that something was and wasn't existing, and that I wouldn't put my foot into the mud if there was one. So it was. It's. I think it's quite not clever the way he's put his statement in 11 pages. But I do think that it's a bit like the Donald Jr. Release of email, trying to help himself. He revealed a bit too much of his game, and he can't put himself as the innocent victim who didn't know how a campaign worked after this 11-page statement.
Sebastian, the statement has obviously been, you know, comprehensively lawyered, so it's unlikely that it was going to give much away. But the other thing that struck me as weird was he claims to have, you know, that Sergei Kislyak, the Russian ambassador, made so little impact on him that later in the campaign, or after Trump had won the election, he emailed someone else asking him who the Russian ambassador was. Why would you not just tap Russian ambassador to the United States into Google?
Look, I respectfully disagree with what's been said so far. I think it's a masterful statement. I think it shows us all the difference there is between Donald Trump Jr. and Jared Kushner. I mean, it's not, I admit, not terribly difficult to come across as slightly smarter than Donald Trump Jr. but Mr. Kushner certainly does. And we all around this table, and presumably most of our listeners, will agree that Kushner is guilty as charged, because we, you know, there's so much evidence, there's a mountain of circumstantial evidence.
Well, even by his own admission in this statement, there was a persistent pattern of attempts to communicate
attempts
by Russia.
And I'm sorry, is it in the Constitution, or is it at least clearly laid down by law? You cannot consort with a foreign power. And please don't give me all that naivety stuff about not really knowing what Russia is about, where Russia lies, and who the ambassador is. I don't, you know, we all, everybody who's in politics, and particularly in Washington D.C., will have noticed that there's been a deterioration of relations to Russia for about what, 10, 15 years now. This is all ridiculous. But again, I think this is not for our consumption. This is for, as you quite rightly pointed out, it's the question: is this legally relevant? I would argue no, it isn't. Is this politically damaging? Well, I mean, he won't win over people like us. He needs to keep to the president. The president needs to stick to his base. And I don't think any of this will make any impact on the people who voted for Donald Trump and are still loyal to him.
Well, we will doubtless have more on that on tonight's episode of The Monocle Daily. But finally, for this episode of Midori House, to President Donald Trump himself and the possibility that he sees an opportunity to crush his worst enemy. Not, obviously, such relative minor nuisances as Islamic State or North Korea, but CNN. The US Justice Department is considering a bid by AT&T for Time Warner, CNN's owner. US newspaper reports suggest, unsurprisingly, that Trump may perceive this as a stick with which he can thrash his nemesis. Murray, how confident are you that Trump's attitude to CNN will play absolutely no part in the Justice Department's deliberations?
Oh, well, that's a very specific question that I wouldn't be able to answer specifically, but I'm sure he's going to try and pull his weight through Twitter or any other mean and try and undermine CNN as much as he can, because that's a real opportunity for him in a way. I mean, it's not as if there was no change in CNN at the moment. There has to be changes. So why not basically going through the back door, the front door, and try to decredibilize CNN the way he did. And the problem is that a few days, weeks ago, CNN really shot themselves in the foot with this story about Scaramucci.
The incoming communications director, yes.
Yeah, the new man, basically, of the communication. And he was accused by CNN, a story that was only on the internet, to have had linked with a Russian investment fund. And a few days after that, the day after the story was taken out of the internet, and a few days after that, the two journalists and the head of the investigation department in CNN had to resign because the story was not substantiated enough. It's not that the story was untrue, it's just that they didn't have enough information or source to rely on to be able to really do this story. So
makes a change from the Trump administration, doesn't
well,
it?
Resigning. Well, what also made a change from the Trump administration was Scaramucci's own response. He accepted the apology, said it was a classy move, and that he was moving on, which is not something you would catch his new boss doing. But on which subject, Sebastian, how serious do you think, or do we think, Trump's attacks on CNN really are? He understands that there is a symbiotic relationship here, doesn't he? He understands that if he wails on CNN, one, it winds up his base, two, it gets him on television, which are the two things he cares most about.
Yes, again, this is, I think, this is a tremendous business deal. You know, we're talking $85 billion.
It is huge.
I cannot for the life of me see, if these two companies, Time Warner and AT&T, have clearly worked out that it's beneficial for them, and nobody has so far suggested that there are any competition issues there, then I can't see how the Justice Department could use CNN as a reason to stop this deal. Trump will make noise. Well, you know, what's new?
Yeah, well, indeed, he always does. But I mean, it's an interesting test case, though, isn't it, Mari? Because this is it's one of the problems with authoritarianism. It's not that people need to be told what to do. It's just that people start doing what they imagine they would be told to do if anyone was going to tell them to do it. Will the Justice Department necessarily feel compromised if indeed Jeff Sessions is still leading it? There are rumours that he may not be long for the gig.
Well, yes, of course. It's not too much in the little papers of Donald Trump. Since he recused himself in the Trump investigation. That's not something that Trump...
Trump himself has described Sessions today as beleaguered. I'm not sure Trump knows what the word means, but nonetheless.
He might have seen the film with Nicole Kidman, something like that. I wanted to put the word out. But, well, the thing is, I mean, it has to be a very... as I think it's going to be a very, very much on the front of the pages thing, the fact that Donald Trump would like to make it an issue, kind of vindicating himself in terms of the way he's being portrayed to the media. That's a golden opportunity for him.
Mari Bion and Sebastian Borger, thank you for joining us. That brings us to the end of today's show, which was produced by Ben Ryle and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Hester Underhill. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. Music next. Next at 1900, Robert Bound is in with a culture show. I'm back with more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.